science fiction writer of our acquaintance, I happen to know, is working on a story that's sort of like told by a sideline person, one of the people who's not quite but almost collateral damage in Total Recall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's going to be a really good story when she gets around to writing.
So what we're talking around what we're sort of beating around the bush about here is that
One second. Before we do that.
We have to say this is WBAI at 99.5, and this is Hour of the Wolf continuing, or Beyond the Wolf, or whatever.
But what it is not is As I Please, which would be normally starting now and would be on its last normal show if it weren't for the fact that Simon is already suspended. So he can't be here this morning sharing with you. But, you know, stay tuned to WBAI for news about Simon. I believe there should be ultimately some good news about that. But if you want to see Simon yourself, go to the Swift on Monday. He just sent me an email. It's the 22nd. Oh, it's not this Monday. I made a mistake, and he made a mistake. It's because he made a mistake, but he just sent me an email. I'm glad I checked it. It's a week from Monday. It's a week from Monday, November 22nd. It's still opposite the Sifwa shindig.
Right.
But a week from Monday, the 22nd, at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street. For more information, 212-260-3600 for the sermon from Moby Dick. And, you know, it's like, oh, forget that Orson Welles thing in that Gregory Peck movie that Ray Bradbury wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Watch Simon do it.
So what we were talking about is that in the last
about a year and a half.
In the last year and a half, I have read 124 vampire novels. And so I want to tell you why I've done that and why I've sort of been thinking about that. And I'm actually going to write a nonfiction book about the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, and vampires, and why vampires at this moment in time have so much traction. So it started completely unroutinely. I was on my way to a festival and happened to be in the airport and needed a book to read. And they had this deal, you know, where you basically buy them and then can return them, you know, and just for a very little money. And I saw this paperback and I had nothing to read. And I said, what the heck? You know, I'll read the first Twilight book. So I took the first Twilight book to Florida and was reading it at this festival. And I have to tell you, the only vampire interest I had ever previously had, I guess I had read The Vampire Lestat, and I'd read maybe Interview of the Vampire a long time ago, and I'd read Whitley Strieber's The Hunger, and had seen the movie The Hunger. And I have to say that that incredible movie with Catherine Deneuve and, you know, and Susan Sarandon and David Bowie, I thought was amazing. I even had a couple of fantasy moments, I will admit, putting myself in various of the characters in that movie. But except for that, except for having read The Hunger and seen The Hunger, except for having maybe read, you know, a Rice novel or two, I had never had any interest whatsoever in vampires. So I read the first Twilight novel, and you know, I got sort of hooked into the plot or whatever, and I returned it to the airport and picked up the second one, and went home. And 10 days later, my husband got diagnosed with serious stomach cancer, stage 4 stomach cancer, and was sick for the next 9 months and then died. And during the time that I was taking care of him, and I stopped work, I worked maybe 2 days a week instead of regularly, went on family medical leave, was taking care of him and sitting by his bedside, and he was going through chemo and radiation and all kinds of other horrible things. And during that period, I needed a couple of escapes. So I started walking around the reservoir 5 miles a day. That was one of my escapes. And my other escape was I sort of obsessively started reading vampire novels. And, you know, I went from the Twilight novels to all the Sookie Stackhouse novels. And then I read the 2 sequels to Strieber's The Hunger. And then I went on and on and on. I just started almost obsessively, of course. I went back and I read, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I read Interview with a Vampire, and I read, you know, but then I went on and on and on and read all the teen novels. I read the detective novels that I read some of the, you know, there's all this African-American vampire fiction. There's near porn. I mean, we can go on and on. I'll give you my annotated list at some point later in the show. I mean, there's some amazing, and there's actually some really amazingly beautiful stuff. There are what I would call very literary coming-of-age novels. There's a woman named Susan Hubbard, who's written The Society of S, The Year of Disappearances, and The Season of Risk. There's an amazing book by Michael Talbot, the guy who wrote The Holographic Universe, who's now deceased, and he wrote a book called The Delicate Dependency. It's out of print. It's a very strange but wonderful vampire novel. There are all these teen, nerdy vampire novels which turn the genre on its head, such as one called it, one fabulous novel by Kimberly Pauley called Sucks to Be Me, with the sequel Still Sucks to Be Me. And all these sort of pimply, you know, like kids who get turned to be vampires when they're 15.
Well, Veronica Shaines, who I mentioned last week, wrote one, you know, where a 15-year-old girl is turned into a vampire, and it's like, you know, why couldn't it have happened until my acne went away?
Well, exactly. You know? That's like Suck It Up is like that. Now, I haven't read that one. I'll have to read it. You'll have to tell me what the title is.
It hasn't published yet.
Oh, it isn't. Well, there's another one already out like
that. I'm
not
sure if she sold it.
There's already one out called Suck It Up, which is about a 15-year-old boy with acne. It's the same idea. And it's a very, very good book. And then there's some just fabulous series. There's a series called the House of Night series, which is completely Wiccan, totally Wiccan, by a mother. Daughter couple, a mother-daughter pair, basically from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Anyway, it goes on and on. So I started obsessively reading these books.
And let's mention Elijah Johnson, who's on
well,
the show.
Well, I read, I read Moonshine, Elijah Johnson's book, and it went on and on and on. So anyway, I started obsessively reading these books. And as I was reading these books, I kept on saying to myself, so why am I doing this? What is going on here? Why am I completely obsessed by this? And I was becoming totally obsessed by vampire novels. And I have to say that I was not, to get back to the sort of original point that Jim had mentioned, I was not really obsessed by the horror ones. I had a lot of issues about, I mean, Let the Right One In is very interesting, the Swedish novel, and the Swedish movie is very, very interesting. But quite frankly, books like The Passage or The Strain, books that essentially have the vampires as what I would call non-conscious monsters. Sort of in The Strain, they're completely unconscious. In The Passage, they're pretty barely conscious. I find those not interesting at all. I want my vampires to be conscious and struggling with moral issues, which I think is actually, I'm going to get to this in a minute, which I think is actually the most interesting thing about vampire novels, is that they are struggling with moral questions and the moral questions that, in fact, we are struggling with right now. So I started thinking to myself, okay, why is this happening? And the first thing that was obvious was that I was meditating on mortality. I was watching my husband, you know, be sick and the question of dying. And my husband was, how would I put this? My husband was one of these people who was, we had both read 1,000 science fiction novels when we had met. And he has what I would call the science fictional high-tech view of death, which was that he was going to defeat it at any cost, that he took, you know, all these supplements, he was in perfect health, he was a runner, he never smoked, he never took a drug. He was like, you know,
yeah, he actually would approach the microwave with a 10-foot pole.
Yes, exactly. He wouldn't let, when I got pregnant, he, you know, took one of those, you know, he was looking around the house for what kind of low frequency, you know, was where and where I shouldn't go and how many hours I could spend on the computer a day, you know, and all that. I mean, he was like, you know, and he was like the perfect, you know, this for this guy to get stomach cancer, particularly a kind of cancer that was mostly gotten by people who were like in Korea or Japan who had a particular diet. And he was like a wheat germ yogurt kind of salad guy, you know. He was, you know, maybe he ate a little chicken and stuff like that. But he, you know, he was like in perfect health. He was a runner. And so this came completely out of the blue. And he was the kind of person who, if I had said that anybody was a candidate to live to be 100, he was going to be one of those people. So I realized that he had that view of death, that death was to be defeated at any cost, and that I was growing up in this pagan nature world, which had a very different view of death, which was that death is part of a natural cycle, that we, you know, we are born, we grow, we, you know, it's like we're like the trees. We, you know, there's spring, there's fall, there's winter, there's regeneration, but essentially we are like the, we go back into the elements. We are air, we are fire, we are earth, you know. And I remember reading this fabulous description of the idea that, I don't even know if it's true, but it's just such a wonderful metaphor, that the way the sort of ancient notion of the elements, earth, air, you know, water, fire, came into being was they were the ways that we go into death, that essentially we're either burned on the pyre or we're left for carrion or we go into the sea or we are buried in the earth, and that they are in fact the ways we die. So I realized there was a tension between my own view of death, which I wasn't completely at one with, because there was a part of me that was sort of into my husband's view of death and my husband's view of death. And I realized that almost every vampire novel has that tension in it, because there's the belief and the belief in the desire for immortality. And yet, as, for example, Rosalie says in one of the Twilight movies, I don't want to be this. I'm frozen. I want to have kids. I want to be part of this. You know, she wants to be part of the cycle. And so there's this tension, I think, in a lot of vampire novels between immortality as good and being wanting to be part of the cycle of life. Immortality is not good. So that was clearly the beginning. But I said, no, that's not. I don't buy that that's the reason why this is happening in the society, why all these people, both teens and adults, are reading all these books. It's not about death. And it's also, I don't think it's about sex. All these articles are saying it's all about sex. It's all about, oh, Twilight is all about, you know, repressed sexuality and abstinence and all this kind of stuff. And I said, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. Particularly if you look at the last movie, the last Twilight movie, at the very end, Bella says, as she's with Edward in this loving, she suddenly says, you think this is about you. It's not about you. It's about me and the choices I want to make. Mm. And I realize Bella, an only child of divorce like me, was basically from a middle class family that was pretty nothing. I mean, her father was a cop, her mother, you know, and she's making this choice between extended families that are like tribal and working class versus upper class. I mean, she's trying to choose who the heck she is. And that's what teens are trying to do. They're trying to figure out who their, you know, what their identity is, what their choice is. And also, let's face it, every single teen, including, I mean, if I wanted to say, what was I into when I was a teenager and what am I still into way down deep now in my fantasies, is I'm really identifying with the persecuted other. Mm. You know, the persecuted other, which is like the X-Men or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. The persecuted other, that person who is not understood by society, the stranger in a strange land, vampire novels fit really into that. But it still isn't explaining everything to me. I still don't get why this is happening. So then I went to academics and I started talking to academics about, you know, who were studying vampires and folklore and studying the movies and studying the literature. And one thing became very, very clear. I actually did a piece about this for NPR, that the waves of interest in vampires, never been fads, but there have been waves, and the waves have often lasted a decade. And those waves have always happened as a result of a particular fear and concern. So, give you two examples. 1816, first vampire novel in the English language. Where does it happen? Same chalet. Same weekend, Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein.
And 19-year-old Mary Shelley.
Right. And so Polidori writes this first vampire novel story in the English language. What's happening? What's the fear of concern in that chalet? Science playing God. You know, all the stuff that was happening that resulted in both that vampire novel and Frankenstein.
Both science fiction and horror invented that weekend.
That weekend. Right. Exactly. Then, okay, 1897, Bram Stoker writes Dracula. What's happening? England has the largest ports in the world. It is essentially frightened to death of disease and immigration coming into its shores. So you have this Eastern European character bringing dirt from a foreign land, right? You know, perfect mirroring of fears and concerns. So you can go through this and you can look at the Anne Rice period and everything, and you could look at AIDS and what's happening in that, et cetera. So I started looking at that, and then I said, well, okay, but what's happening now? And I started looking at the vampires that were most popular in our culture right now. So you've got Edward Cullen and the whole Cullen family. Mm-hmm. You've got Bill Compton in True Blood. You've got Henry Fitzroy in the Tanya Huff novels. Very interesting. These are beautiful detective novels, by the way, in which there's this incredible tension between Victoria, who is this Toronto-based cop, and Michael Cellucci, this cop. She's a cop. She's a retired. She had to get out of the force because of her vision problems, but she's still a PI. And this fabulous cop named Michael Cellucci, and this Henry Fitzroy, 400-year-old bastard son of Henry VIII, vampire. And they team up to basically solve crimes. Anyway, so Henry Fitzroy, I looked at him. And he's odd because he's a Christian, even though he's a vampire. Very interesting. And then I looked at Mick St. John, one of my favorites from the CBS show Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at the new BBC drama, The Guy in Being Human. Very interesting show. And that, so I started looking at all. And then I looked at Stefan and Damon in The Vampire Diaries.
By the quick note, the Aidan Quinn, the fellow who plays the vampire in Being Human, is going to be Gimli in The Hobbit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I looked at these. I just like sort of wrote all these down, and I looked at all these people, and I said, well, what do they have in common? And how are they different from the Dracula of Bram Stoker and of different periods? You know, what is it about them today? And I went, oh, my God, they're all struggling to be moral despite being predators. Every single one of them is struggling to be moral despite being predators. And who are we right now? As oil is our blood, as we suck the lifeblood out of the planet, as we wage two wars, we are desperately failing mostly, but struggling to be moral despite being predators. So they are us. They reflect us right now. And when I said that to Whitley Strieber, he said, yes, and our prey is the planet. So, right? Okay. So I went, wow. So this is my thesis. And then just recently I came back from the AAR, which is the American Academy of Religion. And I actually heard a paper by a woman called Green Vampires, in which she shows through all these fabulous slides of movies and books and other things, etc. She shows all these sort of examples that are somewhat close to what I was saying, sort of earth-based, you know, and she has a scene from True Blood, which I had seen but had completely forgotten, which is one of the funniest scenes in the world, in which Bill Compton is telling Jessica, this vampire he turned, this young girl, and he's saying, you know, you can't feed on humans and you have to be this. And then he says, and by the way, we recycle. And there's like this and there's like this scene in which he's actually holding up the recycle bins, the ones, you know, the blue and one, right? You know?
Oh, God.
And she has this fat, it's like, and she has this as a slide in her Green Vampires thing, which is really, really funny. Anyway, so basically that's sort of the thesis I'm going for right now, is this whole notion that vampires are us and that they represent this sort of struggle that we're going through. And the other issue that I think is really powerful in these novels, in most of these novels, is that they're all about power. They're not about sex. They're about power. Oh, of course, there's lots of sex, and there's lots of love, and there's romance, and all this kind of stuff.
And of course, there's the power of sex. There's the whole sexual politics.
Well, you know, the other thing is, you know, just as rape, everybody thought it was about sex, but it's really about power.
Right.
So these are all a lot about power and the abuse of power. And one of the academics that I talked to, who I absolutely love, who's at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, she said a very interesting thing. She said, the issues that are in most good vampire novels and movies are very much the issue of, well, now that we're superior, do we treat humans as cattle, as food? Or were we once human? Since we were once human, do we treat them as human beings and ourselves as human beings? Do we remember our humanity? And she said, how different is that question from, if I have more money than you, how do I treat you? If I have more power than you, how do I treat you? Does might make right in some sense? And she says all the best of these novels, if you look at them very deeply, really deal with this question of abuse of power and use of power. So that's kind of, so these are the kind of things that I'm playing with, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a book proposal running around, and I've gotten a few offers, and something's going to happen. So that's what I'm doing. And meanwhile, I've also got my annotated list of 124 vampire novels, which I'm going to have to.
Like some that alone is you've got.
Well, I have to tell you something.
You've got to build a website. Well, we're going to build you a website,
right? Well, I have to tell you some of the funny things.
You have to build a website just around that,
around the annotated list.
Oh yeah.
Well, I have to tell you some of the funny things that are around that people just don't even know about. For example. Among the teen novels, there are all these series. You know, they're what I call Hogwarts for vampires, which is, you know, there are all these series that are based in kind of special schools for vampires. So House of Night is one of those. And that's the one I said was very Wiccan. And then there's Vampire Academy series, which is very Russian. It's a kind of very Russian series of schools. And then there's this sort of Evernight series, which takes place in another type of vampire special school for vampires. But this one has regular people in it, too. They don't even know. Know that the others are vampires, which is a whole other thing. And then there's sort of vampires at school, and some of these are the weirdest of the lot. There is a series called Blue Bloods. Imagine Gossip Girls plus vampires. What this author has done, I have it down here. I should get her name. But anyway, this Blue Bloods series is a series of so far about five books, maybe five or six books. And it takes place on the Upper East Side of Manhattan in East Side private schools. And the notion in this Blue Bloods series is that the 401st families on the Mayflower are really... Da, 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 da.
Oh, my
and
God.
And wait a minute. But they're really the reincarnations of the archangels, actually. But they're also these kind of vampires.
This is Melissa De La Cruz.
Exactly. Melissa De La Cruz, yes, the Blue Bloods series. And it is so bizarre, but it's sort of so odd. And I sort of, as I was reading this, I started laughing because I said, oh, so that's why the Upper East Side people are social x-rays. They don't need to eat. They're vampires. That's why they're so thin, right? We now understand the whole Tom Wolfe phenomenon, right, of social x-rays. It's really that they're blue bloods. They're really vampires, right? So
it also explains the menu at – what's the name of that restaurant on the Upper East Side that everybody goes to?
There are millions of them. Elaine's?
Elaine's. Elaine's, yes. Yeah.
The special menu at Elaine's, right? Anyway, so there's, you know, then there are the what I would call the detective. There's a huge genre of detective vampire novels. So we have P.N. Elrod's like 12 novels or something like that or more that take place in Chicago in the 30s with a vampire detective. And then we have my favorite one, which is Charles Houston. It's a noir dystopian New York City. With a vampire detective named Joe Pitt, really sort of kind of hard-nosed, you know, kind of detective guy, but he's a vampire. But it all takes place in this very gang-ridden noir New York that there's one novel that half of it takes place on the A train. It's really quite extraordinary, actually. And so that's another one of these detective series. And then, of course, there's the Tanya Huff novels. There's fabulous African American vampire fiction. I mean,
well, of course,
fabulous.
we
have Terrence Taylor, of course, and Aliyah Johnson, and of course, Octavia Butler's Fledgling.
Yeah.
A really, really beautiful book written, you know, now she's unfortunately died. But
she was starting to promote that book, in fact.
Really?
She was on tour at that point. For Fledgling.
It's promoted.
She was about to go on tour when she died with, she was going to tour with Nalo Hopkinson, promoting that.
Right. Then there's L.A. Banks. Well, this, we get into sort of what I would call the slayer near porn, the near porn slayer stories, which include on the white side, Laurel K. Hamilton, who has written, I mean, that's a really strange story. She started, her book started out, she's got Anita, these are the Anita Blake novels, and they started out, she starts out as this good Catholic girl who would never have anything to do with a vampire. By book 10, you know, she's stooping two vampires, the head of a werewolf clan. Her day job is as an animator, which is that, you know, she raises zombies from the dead so that basically, lawyers
can... different definition for animator.
So basically, she raises them from the dead so that, for example, you know, you want to really find out what was in Aunt Sadie's will, right? It's really bizarre.
But
unfortunately, as the books have gone on, and I finally read the first 10, and then I went, I cannot go on, because she's gotten very into S&M and torture and a lot of other stuff. This is the Anita Blake novels. This is Laurel K. Hamilton. So they get progressively and more progressively sort of sexual. Now, someone has said to me that somewhere around book 18, which I think she's on, or 18 or 19, they come back into really good storytelling, and that she sort of went, she went through this phase where it was just sex and torture, and I suddenly went, you know, I'm not reading any more of these. Then there's L.A. Banks, you know, who has sort of the, has 12 or 14 novels. And she has created this. She has sort of the African-American version of this, which is a very powerful heroine who's sort of a poet and rapper, rock star. And there's also a lot of sensuality, and it's much more Kemetic and kind of, you know, there's kind of an Egyptian religion, kind of sort of black Egyptian.
An Hour of the Wolf wherever it ends up.
And it's
up.
There's a lot of street language, a lot of rapper language. It's a very different take on the sort of vampire genre and quite interesting. I've read the first three of those, and then I sort of said, okay. And then there's some just really beautiful books. There's a book called Sunshine by, is it my McKinley, I think is her name. Really beautiful novel. There's a woman named Poppy Z. Bright.
Oh, yes.
Right. And she wrote a book called Lost Souls.
Right.
Very, very lyrical, gorgeous writing, pretty horror oriented, but pretty dark, but extremely beautiful writing. Just incredible. And as I said, I don't – oh, and then, you know, one of my favorites – there are a couple of new ones that have come out. There's a book that just came out. Somewhere I have the author. I don't remember the author, but it's her name. The book is called Dracula in Love, and it is a retelling of the entire Dracula story from a totally feminist point of view. And so what that means is that the villains are no longer Dracula. The villains are the male medical establishment that's experimenting on Lucy and all these other people. Mm. And Lucy is dying blood is being put into her that they don't understand how blood works and that, you know, it has to be the right type and all. They don't know what they're doing. And they're essentially killing these women as they experiment on hysteria and try to treat, you know, in their view, their hysterical symptoms. And so it's quite an amazing take on the sort of the horrors of the medical profession. It's quite a brilliant book. Another book that came out this year that really intrigued me, and it didn't get a lot of traction compared to The Passage, which my problem with The Passage was, The Passage got on all the bestseller lists. You know, it's very much like Stephen King's The Stand. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, disease gets out of the lab and completely decimates the world, and small bands of people try to create, you know, try to preserve civilization and sort of create some kind of an alternate new world as a result. And you know, but again, the vampires are sort of not very conscious, and therefore, and by the end of the first book, which is 760 something pages, by the end of the first book,
wow.
All the characters I really cared about had died. And so there was a part of me that said, why am I going to read part two when all the characters that I want to, you know, are dead? Right. And I had the same reaction to the Strain, which is the first of a trilogy. That had better characters, and they did live, but the vampires are total monsters. And, you know, until you get some tension between humans and vampires, I don't think it's particularly interesting. The book that I loved, that I thought was really fun, and that didn't get that much traction, is called Blood Oath by Christopher Farnsworth. And it is the combination of a presidential thriller – a la West Wing.
You did an NPR piece.
Yes,
on that.
I did an NPR review on that and The Passage, right. It is a sort of a presidential thriller and a vampire novel. And the conceit in that book, which I think is quite brilliant, is that in 1867, in the time of after the Civil War, in the time of President Andrew Johnson, he supposedly, and apparently this is all taken from some weird, maybe Lovecraftian reference or something in some book somewhere about a vampire and that it was on a pirate ship or something in the after the Civil War or something. There's some reference somewhere, but anyway, so the idea is that this vampire was on a ship and he got imprisoned and he was going to be executed in some way, and Andrew Johnson comes in and he gets Mary Laveau in The Witch to put a curse on this vampire so that he is forced to serve every president of the United States for the rest of his existence. And so this vampire, Nathaniel Cade, if I remember correctly, is this incredible character. He's very taciturn. He's very world-weary is what I would call him. On the other hand, he is devoted to his service. He's almost like a 20 character out of 24, a kind of, real. He's like, a real secret agent kind of character. But on the other hand, he, in his spare time, when he has a minute, he'll stand in the back of a room of an AA meeting because he feels that he is an addict, you see. Mm-hmm. And he feels that he is addicted. And even though he is only drinking, I think, animal blood at this point, but he still has this lust for human blood. And so he goes to these AA meetings and stands in the background. And to me, that was another one of these symbols that I'm sort of using for the work that I'm trying to do. And that I think we are all addicted. We're all addicted to oil. We're all addicted to whatever. And that we're all sort of, trying to figure out how to live an uncompromised life. That isn't completely compromising the planet, and we're not succeeding very well, So he was another symbol that I found very, very attractive in my search for this, what I would call the wannabe moral, struggling to be moral vampires.
Yeah. And I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. And as I've been talking to you and following your immersion
in this, yes.
Into this, it became clear to me at a certain point when I was asking you, had you seen this? Did you know that? I followed you as you began your ascent into Buffydom.
Oh, yes. And I watched all 144 episodes of Buffy.
Buffy is utterly amazing.
Amazing. And I am now in season 5 of Angel.
Yeah. Angel wasn't as good as Buffy.
But I've fallen in love with Joss Whedon. It's a really amazing
character.
You haven't
done Firefly.
Not yet. I know. I've heard. But I have to finish Angel first.
Yeah. Firefly and Serenity.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, just, if you want to break, Dr. Horrible's blog. That's a musical.
Right.
So
you were saying, as you had been following.
Yeah, I became able to predict what would or wouldn't appeal to you. And I didn't have the word that you described earlier, but that word is redemption. I certainly saw the need for immortality, the mm-hmm. need for existence
right.
beyond that,
right.
so that even if it's compromised, we can continue to love people who are important, even if who they are is compromised by, vampirism.
Or whatever.
Or whatever it may be. But the redemption is a very important part, that these have to be somehow, despite whatever they're going through, there should be some good in them.
Right,
Or desire for good.
Exactly.
And all that. Although, going back to what you were saying about vampires not being about sex.
Only about sex.
There's
a little sex going on there. Yeah, right. Clearly.
But. I mean, one of the most sexual depictions of vampires early on was that incredible staged version of Dracula with Frank Langella, with the Edward Gorey sets that was directed by a close friend of yours.
Directed by someone who is the person who has the closest I'm an only child, but is the closest person to being a brother to me. Mm-hmm. And that's Dennis Rosa, who directed the Broadway. Dennis Rosa was taken in by my mother when I was 14 and he was 21 as a boarder, as someone to help pay the rent. And he was at that time an actor. As a matter of fact, I watched him, I'll never forget that very early on, I watched him try out for the, I guess, the replacement, you know, in Camelot for, the Seven Deadly Virtues, those ghastly.
Roddy McDowall.
Yes, exactly. He was going to replace Roddy McDowall, exactly. And, wow. But he didn't, but he was up for it, and I was watching him sing it. It turned out later that he was a reasonable actor, but he was much better as a director, and so he ended up being a director. He ended up directing Dracula, and he ended up, later he went to the University of Missouri, and, he went to, yeah, anyway, whatever the one is in Kansas City, and he went,
University of Kansas.
No, it wasn't, no. There's Kansas City, Missouri, too. There's Kansas City, Kansas, and there's Kansas City, Missouri. Anyway, he ended up, I think he was at the university. He ended up, doing stuff in a university, and now he's in San Francisco writing a book of some kind. I don't know what. I haven't seen him in years and years and years. But he, in fact, yes, he did direct that.
And that was a great production.
Yeah, and the gory sets were amazing.
They were wonderful. The idea that it was all so black and white as all of gory's stuff was,
Except for the red.
The touch of red.
The touch of red.
Beautifully done. And that production of Dracula, I think, brought it into the modern era with the full raw power of the sexuality.
Right.
People say that they somehow see sex in Bela Lugosi. I can't imagine that. And maybe Christopher Lee had, you know, a touch of the perversion in what he did in the Hammer films. But that production of Dracula on Broadway, I think, may have actually been partly key to reviving an interest, which is now a decades old.
Well,
interest.
That was in the 70s.
That was in the 70s. Yeah. But think about it. That's where the books start, where the fiction starts reappearing, the slash fiction, all the fanfic and stuff starts the renaissance, the rebirth of the vampire in popular American culture. This is obviously something you're going to be researching for this book of yours. I'm positing the idea that that production may have helped the zeitgeist reemerge.
It's possible. It certainly probably helped that wave in the 80s that happened. Yeah, that wave in the 80s that went on. I don't know. I mean, it's odd because that, I'm trying to even remember how that ends. I'm trying to remember how that Dracula ends. I don't even remember how that musical ends. How did it end?
Which musical?
The play.
It ends with, you know, Van Helsing, you know, putting the stake through Dracula's heart.
That's right.
In a very dramatic, beautifully done
I completely
sequence
forgot in, this. In I'm going to have to, right, yeah.
It's the play. It's the original play based on the Stoker novel. The play, I don't remember,
people are trying to get him, given the interest that's going on right now. I did talk to Dennis on the phone. But, you know, it's interesting. Apparently, I've talked to some people in the theater, and they say that there has never successfully been a musical on vampires that has worked on Broadway, that it's almost a legend that it always flops. Now, I'm not sure. Someone was telling me this. I have no idea. I haven't looked back and seen which were the ones that flopped, but apparently there were a couple that were actually attempts through the years, and they all flopped. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a kind of famous sort of curse of Broadway that you can't bring it.
There's lots of curses on Broadway.
Right,
you know,
right.
You can't even mention a Scottish play or the
Right. So anyway, so that's the story. That's what's happening.
And it's an amazing intro to something that can go for a very long.
And I actually want to get one of the things I do want to do is I want to get in touch with teens. I want to go to classes. I want to, you know, go to schools. I want to find out, you know, because I have this whole theory, but I want to find out what teens particularly are thinking
about
this.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, when you speak, often they're very unconscious about what they're doing, you know, so they'll say, oh, I just really like Bill Compton, or I just really like Edward, or, you know, or Jacob, or whatever that, you know, their thing is. But they won't really talk about what's happening in there, because some of them are not really able to sort of articulate what's really going on.
Some of the writers for those teens.
Yes.
People like Leslie Banks and all that probably
have some sense.
And Terrence Taylor is very, very well spoken on the whole vampire topic.
Yeah,
so
So I have to. Yeah. So anyway, I have a lot of interviews in the works that are going to happen at some point.
And I'm very interested if you're going to be dealing at all with the sort of subculture.
I haven't. I'll tell you the strange thing.
That's dark.
That's very dark. But it's very complicated. It's very complicated. So for Halloween, I did this really fun story. I found this woman
on
NPR.
Yeah.
This is a woman named Ra Ubasti, and she actually works in that costume store on 43rd Street, West 43rd Street. There's a huge Halloween Adventure, I think it's called.
Okay,
it's a
huge
costume store on West 43rd Street. And she works out of there, but she also is an artist. And she is one of New York's custom fang makers. And so I actually had her come up to the studio and make me a pair of fangs, right? And I did the cheapest version, you know, just sort of two incisors, you know, nothing else. But apparently people come up to her and say, I would like my fangs to be like Interview with a Vampire, and that involves like three sets, whatever, three different ones. Or I want them to be like Lost Boys, or I want them to be like, you know, Brooklyn Vampires of Brooklyn, which I've never heard of, which is apparently another movie
that's Eddie Murphy.
Oh yeah, so I never saw that one, but yet I'm sure it'll be on my list somewhere.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she makes them, and they're beautiful. I mean, she makes them; they're totally custom made, and they're completely beautiful. They're completely totally, you know, they look gorgeous, you know, and they're you just take them out and put them in, but they fit perfectly because they're molded, you know, they're acrylic, they're molded to your teeth, and then she sort of, you know, polishes them down, and so they're really like, you know, little dental cams.
There was a friend who wore a pair of those
at Elias' party, and they were beautiful. I don't know who made them, but so she's one of those. So she was telling me about that community a little bit, and there have been a number of books that have been written about that community, and you know, there are energy vampires, and there are sanguinarians who actually do drink blood. And usually it's done very carefully and tested and this, that, and the other. And
given that some of that arose in the AIDS era.
Right. And yes. And Ra basically said to me that there are a lot less, you know, than, you know, I mean, you know, there's a tendency to think that there are so many all that. But, you know, when she came to New York and sort of wandered into that community, she said that the people who were actually actual sanguinarians were not that many. You know, I mean, it wasn't like there was a huge amount of that. But there are definitely people who, I mean, I know there are vampire-oriented covens that are in the pagan movement I've heard vaguely about. And there are other people who just sort of do it as art and fantasy, which I think is more my mod level.
But, yeah, right.
But, and Whitley said to me, be careful. He said, there's a woman journalist who actually disappeared and who was researching all of that. And, you know, ended up not in a good place. And I said, well, I'm not going into the dark. As I said, I'm much more into the moral vamps. And so, you know.
I was scared when you did a story some 30 years ago on some Virgin Mary cults.
Oh,
the
that
paramilitary.
That was a whole other thing. The people who go up to Queens to oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You know, I was scared for you then. This is darker.
Now, that was, I was pregnant when I did that story. I suddenly realized I was actually, when I went up there, these were the people who
were. So it was
were,
20 years ago then, because we know how old Alex is.
Yeah, these were the people who believed that the site where the Pope had appeared at the World's Fair, mm-hmm. in that pavilion that the Vatican had, was sort of holy ground. And they were having, I don't know if they, for all I know, they still do, they were having basically ceremonies up there. And they were very convinced that all kinds of special things were happening, and that
there were all kinds of very strange things that have gone on the fairgrounds for many years. Many groups of people taking acid. Many.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
No, I off the air. I'll tell you some stories.
Ah, yes, under the big globe. Under the yes. This is Hour of the Wolf, by the way, and. Post or Hour of the Wolf.
Post Hour of the Wolf.
Post Hour of the
Wolf. Hasn't come.
Why the yeah. Wolf Hasn't Come. And I'm Margot Adler.
And I'm Jim Freund.
And we're here. And we
are not Simon Lokely.
We are not Simon Lokely. We are not.
On suspension.
And we are here. And it's, God, it's 7:45.
Yeah. Why don't we take a cut of music?
Uh-huh. And then we can even take some calls. And by the way, I want to say one other thing before I go. For all of you who are dealing with all the vampire stuff, I am really open to suggestions for vampire books and movies and things I haven't read and mm-hmm. haven't seen. I am really, really, really. You can send me a message on Facebook, or you can actually email me. I mean, you know.
And your email address
is madler@npr.org.
MADLER
@npr.org.
So and let me, by the way, give my email address, which is Jim, J-I-M, @ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com.
So I am very interested in suggestions, in attitudes that you might have to the theater, of people to talk to, of and all that. I'm definitely slowly, you know, books that I should read that I haven't.
Outside of the 120
that I have. Just the beginning, just the tip of the iceberg.
Really? Oh, God.
I tell you, I have actually a bibliography of vampire books that is in, it's in one big vampire collection that I haven't even read the short stories of yet, but that has a lot of interesting stuff that came out, I think, about a year ago. And they have, like, I noticed, I counted all the listings, and there were 5,000 listings.
Yeah,
and that was a year ago, and, you know, that was, probably didn't even have some of the stuff.
Well, I know a vampire movie you have to watch.
Yes.
Hour of the Wolf.
I probably do.
Well, it is easily interpreted as a vampire film, but, you know, it's Bergman. You have to see it. It's not your typical horror movie.
Yeah.
It's, you know, is it it? Is it real? But it definitely involves vampirism. No question about it. And not a great Bergman film, but, you know, bad Bergman films are right. better than most other films.
Right.
And I believe, by the way, the whole movie is available for free on Google Video.
Now, I will tell you one other thing before we put the cut of music on that I have to tell you, which is that during this period, I also, you know, you were telling me about the Seaver fantasy. So I've had my own... I've had my own fan fiction fantasy.
Oh, my God.
I have created it takes certain attitudes out of Twilight, takes one of the characters, Alice, for those of you who know anything about Twilight, creates a completely different world in the modern times that sort of has certain elements of True Blood, and that vampires do come out of the closet, so to speak. And her sister, Mariah, is an environmental activist. There's a whole other... Anyway, there's this whole saga, and I've kind of created this whole fan fiction world that I've sort of been spending at least a half an hour of my time every day in. I should tell you, I am the Alice character at the moment, although I've taken on the Mariah and Cal character certain times, and I've had a lot of fun with this, I have to tell you. And I have all kinds of wild things. She ends up marrying a fisherman. Well, she can't legally marry him, but she's sort of partnered. And they actually she can't have kids, but he has through, you know, surrogacy or whatever. They have twin boys. And it's a whole, I have this completely crazy, crazy fantasy that I've dealt with on all of this. Anyway, that's the way I will get into the fiction, is I'll start writing fan fiction. And then
well, that's the way, I mean, people like Naomi Novik. mm-hmm. you know, who writes these wonderful dragon fantasy novels mm-hmm. and all that. She started with fanfic.
Well,
she's trying to put out fanfic awards and actually codify all this.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
She's
really?
A great writer. She's
right,
a great writer.
Right, right.
A neat person. You're hearing Naomi? Anyway.
Well, ever since I read
and
the
Peter
Kraith.
Jackson
ever since,
wrote her books.
And ever
Peter
since
Jackson.
I read the Kraith Collected, you know, the old Star Trek, you know, wonderful fan fiction, you know, I've been sort of a fan of fan fiction myself.
Yeah, well, you should talk to Naomi about this. At any rate, here's an appropriate cut of music, and then we'll be back. Marian Harris.
Wow.
I love that song.
Wow, I'd never heard that.
That song's been a staple on Hour of the Wolf for the last couple of years, you know, and I play it a lot and unembarrassed. It's a wonderful song, and it fits perfectly with everything you were talking about there. And you are?
Margot Adler.
And I am?
Jim Freund.
And this is not Simon Locley's As I Please, because he is currently on suspension, and nor is it Hour of the Wolf, because Hour of the Wolf will be moved from its original time slot that Margot created 38 years ago to a time possibly right now, 7 to 8 a.m., or possibly to somewhere else. We don't know. We don't know. But we will be finding out as changes are afoot. Let me make a couple of announcements, and then we'll go back to some calls, hopefully, yeah, about vampires and all, yes, of this. The announcements are for Simon Locally fans and for people who would be Simon Locally fans if only they knew. On the 22nd, Monday the 22nd, at the Swift, 34 East 4th Street, Simon will be performing the Sermon from Moby Dick. That is, you know, just something to do. This coming Wednesday, November 17th, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, Kathy Koja, a great horror writer and writer of dark fantasy and YA stuff, will be reading, along with Ben Winters, who is the author of a couple of mashup novels, including Android Karenina.
Oh, God. I have to say, we never mentioned the mashups. I think most of them are pretty silly.
Well, okay, so you can come
Dick
to...
Dick and Jane and Vampires, have you seen that?
Yeah, have you seen the
Emma and the Vampires?
The Lake Wobegon one on zombies?
I did read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which And then I read Emma and the Vampires and just said, okay, five pages in. I get it.
The joke is in the title.
Yes.
The joke is in the title. But Kathy... But
well, actually, in the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, the one thing that's funny is that the women really can kick butt.
Okay. So that's this Wednesday. But before Kathy Koja is at KGB, she will be here, WBAI, where she and I will record an interview for wherever Hour of the Wolf may land, because as was pointed out from Bulgaria, it's always Hour of the Wolf somewhere. So that's this Wednesday. Simon is next Monday, a week from Monday. And the next New York Review of Science Fiction readings is December 14th. Go to OurWolf.com to find out more. So if you'd like to call and speak with Margot Adler about
whatever,
and these vampiric things, the number here, WBAI, is 212-209-2900. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Hi. Yes, sorry to hear the news, Jim. Sorry to hear about your loss, Ms. Adler. I need to mention, Ms. Adler, that in Bob Burden's Flaming Carrot, a poet read 200 comic books at once today and became a Dadaist superhero. God knows what's going to become to you. What's going to happen to me?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm taking a break. Actually, I finally decided. The reason I'm reading Gary Chastain's novel is that, you know, the super sad whatever true love story is because I suddenly went. I've read 124 vampire novels, and the only book I've read at all in the last year and a half that wasn't a vampire novel was Game Change. So I think it's time to read something else.
Mm-hmm. I think I've thought about this a little bit because I've read, as far as I'm concerned, too many of them. I'm interested in the systems, and I think this may relate to a fundamental fear of the dark, even though I like the night. And the thing is that vampires, they are rules, which is very different from, you know, being in a formless dark. And the only other thing I can think of is that, or that I've often thought, is that starting in the Reagan years, vampires as soulless psychopathic predators that, you know, like Dick's ideas about androids being necessarily predators because they have no empathy, made me think of corporations.
Oh, by the way, that reminds me, there is a theater version coming up of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And I don't know, except the fact that through Moshe Feder, I've got tickets and I'm going
to
be going.
But wait, let's go. So corporations, let's get back. Yeah. Yes, you were saying.
Well, just corporations can live forever if they don't die. You know, if they're not killed.
Of course. Isn't this great? This is really...
They are persons being people. And they suck our life force and have control over our wills.
I love this. This is great. That's great. It's totally great.
I think I thought of this first after reading Sunglasses After Dark, which what I think was a bit of a pioneering book because
Sunglasses
After Dark by Nancy Collins.
I don't know that book.
It's an excellent book. I think it's really that, or maybe Anno Dracula are the best.
Yeah, Anno Dracula. Yeah, but I hadn't heard of this other one at all.
And you may like the fact that Kim Newman, who wrote Anno Dracula and its many sequels, wrote, I think, his master's thesis on the invasion novel of the 1880s and 1890s.
Right.
And he considered Dracula to be one of those. You know, When William Came, The Battle of Dorking, all these novels about Britain being invaded.
Right, right. And exactly what we were saying about Bram Stoker and the whole notion of
like
disease
Kim
and
lot.
Immigration and all that coming in, again, is a sort of invasion. Definitely.
I'll give you a little spoiler. It's really an amazing thing that Nancy Collins thought of, which is vampires hate mirrors because they are reflected in them.
Well, yes, there's another view that vampires hate mirror because, in fact, they are, they reflect, we are, there's a fabulous line about mirrors, too, that I heard somewhere about that they really are, because they are themselves sort of the reflection. But anyway, what was this?
This is Sunglasses After Dark, and yeah.
That vampires
see themselves as they are, which is rotting corpses. I like the book of Night Watch. I kind of hated the movie, which looked like it was done by someone over-influenced by American action films and perfume commercials.
I like Night Watch.
Well, I haven't read Night Watch either.
I guess you're wrong. The book Night Watch presents vampires more in sort of the traditional Eastern European ideas, being simultaneously powerful and very weak and basically kind of sickly. And also China Mieville in The Scar has something a little bit similar.
Oh, China is always, I mean,
so
I
China
love
has
writing.
Written a vampire?
Yes.
No,
well, not
they're
exactly.
incidental characters.
Well, I actually, one of my more fun ones was the vampires in Monstrous Regiment by Terry Pratchett, which is really fun.
yeah.
I'll get off the line pretty soon. Sorry to take so much time.
Wait a minute. Sunglasses.
But it's been worthwhile, and Margo's taking notes now.
After Dark, and what was it, Night Watch?
Yeah.
No, Night Watch is a movie.
It was a movie.
The woman who used to run at least the L.A. Change of Hobbit wrote a vampire book, which was pure revenge fantasy against the people who, I think, you know, made the bookstore go away.
Yeah.
And there was a book.
I don't know her book, but I know the details.
The absolutely worst book, the contenders for worst vampire book I've ever read was something like Unquenchable by David Dvorkin, which is insanely horrible. I think he was trying. And
there's a new book called Insatiable by Meg Cabot. That just came out this year.
No,
it's actually not too bad.
David Dvorkin with a DV, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Dvorkin, yeah, right.
And there was a book called Live Girls, which was basically Times Square circa 1977 porny vampire film, although
right.
it's not particularly porny.
Gotcha.
Anyway,
well, thank you so much.
Sure. Bye.
Great call. Thanks.
Great call.
Meg Cabot is, her agent is a friend of mine. So.
Right, right. Well, she's the Princess Diaries woman. Right?
Oh, absolutely. And Avalon High, and, you know, everything she writes turns to gold, whether it's, you know, critically fabulous or not.
Right.
But Insatiable is really interesting. And there's a sequel.
Not yet. I actually liked Insatiable.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. Well, we can put you in touch with Meg Cabot for the sequel.
Okay.
Because I think it's due in the spring.
Gotcha.
Okay. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hi. I can't believe it. I've been dialing you since 6:05.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm glad you got through.
Me too. Anyway, first of all, I feel terrible the way they're scrambling our time. And to me, Hour of the Wolf can only come out at 4 o'clock. I stay awake till 5 o'clock just to catch that program. And I've been listening to you for years. And now that I hear the other lady, that Margot, that started it, as far as I'm concerned, it's a sacred hour. And it's part of Pacifica. And I can't see the manager switching all these programs around like it's like a game. I don't know what they're trying to do.
It's a game called survival.
Well, he told me that. I spoke to him. You know what he told me? They're going to have music in the mornings.
That's right.
That's insane.
Well, no, it isn't. Wonderful.
Here's the reason.
I find it insane.
Here's the reason that Jim told me, and I think it's actually very smart. Here's Jim's thinking. Jim's thinking, and I'm going to talk as if I were him, is that the truth is that almost anybody who wants a really smart program in the morning is going to listen to Brian Lehrer. And so, therefore, why compete?
Oh, no, Brian Lehrer doesn't come on early.
That's what we're talking about.
Well, yeah,
I'm talking about 5 o'clock in the morning.
No, that's not going to be music.
He told me it is.
No, so that's going to be a news and public affairs program.
But why would you change such great programming? In fact, I don't think that program should ever die. Hour of the Wolf, as far as I'm concerned, is already archival. It's as important as anything that was ever on. First of all, look at all the great literature you've covered. It began with Sears. How do you say that man's name? Searles, that guy?
Oh, Baird Searles.
Oh, Baird Searles, yes.
It began with all these great people, great writers.
Yeah.
You know you have featured some of the most serious writers. And the lady you talked about that died so prematurely, she was a great author.
Octavia Butler, yeah.
And the same with Susanna Clarke. She's not the same as all these garbage writers. She's a heavyweight. She's brilliant beyond compare.
She is.
Now, don't think that all these, by the way, you're making fun of vampires. Vampires.
I wasn't making fun. I'm not
making fun. No, but you think they're funny.
I didn't.
No. Where did you get that from?
Where did you get the funny?
She laughs a lot, and I find them scary. Real vampires still exist. They do have the incisors, and there are descendants of the real vampires. They're not a myth. It's the truth.
I'm not.
They
I'm talking
about blood. They really did invade graves.
Well, we're talking about the supernatural concept of the undead.
We were not laughing at all. I was talking mostly about moral vampires, about the ones that are struggling to be moral, that are in the current wave of fiction and the current wave of movies that are right now. I agree with that part,
but I still think people forget that there were vampires and there are descendants of vampires. And there are people that do those kind of things. This is why we have incisors. We're not really evolutionally so superior to other animals.
But what we are speaking about when we're dealing with it is the fictional supernatural type.
Yeah, and I'm not ready to say to sign on to that theory. But anyway.
No, that's not a theory. That's a fact.
Anyway.
But anyway, forget about fact. All I'm saying to you is, it doesn't matter. I love Hour of the Wolf, and as far as I'm concerned, I will always be sad. To me, I will celebrate Hour of the Wolf, whether it goes off the air or not. I'll make my own Hour of the Wolf at 5 in the morning, thanks to what I've learned from you being on the air all these years. And
well, I'll still be on the air, just somewhere else. I know, it's not going to be the same. I agree.
Look, you'll be able to go to sleep earlier. It's very great.
I don't want to do that. I wake up just to be in the Hour of the Wolf. And I love Simon. I think it's crazy.
Simon is probably going to be back. That's the rumor.
Oh, you think so? So maybe
it's an opinion.
Not so scary. I hope it's not.
No, I you know, something, he is suspended. He's not offed.
It means that
he's not allowed to do his show for a few weeks.
I find that silly.
Well, you have to know the backstory, and you don't know the backstory. So anyway,
you know what it is, Margo? You don't understand how executives of BAI are no different than the gray suits in the corporate world.
Yeah, but actually, that may be true. That may be all true, but. As a complete outsider who hasn't been to BAI in like decades and hasn't worked, I can still say that when I here's the truth. The truth is that in 1970, whatever, when I was doing the war, when I was sort of helping Paul Fisher do the news and the war summary, 500,000 people listened to the war summary every night. Every night.
In what year now was that? 70?
We're talking about in the 70s.
Early 70s.
In the early 70s, during the height of the Vietnam War.
We easily had more than 500,000 listeners regularly.
And
we had 40,000 subscribers.
When, Jim?
In the early 70s.
So wow. The truth is that there's been really...
That was a great audience.
So there's people are trying to revive that kind of audience. That's what's going on. So sometimes they're making bad decisions, sometimes they're making good decisions, but there's an understanding that BAI has to survive, try to figure out some ways to increase its audience.
And I must say the programming has been static in many ways for many years. And while I am not happy about what's happening to me, I am happy that some change
that seems largely positive.
Let me tell you something. I mean, I'm going to tell you about another institution and show you, you know, how change works and how weird it is. You know, there are people at NPR who, for example, have never forgotten that Bob Edwards was taken off NPR.
Oh,
and they
God.
Go on and on and on and on and on about how what a horrible decision that was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Bob Edwards has his own show now on another station and all kinds of stuff is happening, but they still haven't gotten over that. But the fact was that the reason that Bob Edwards was let go was not because, you know, he was horrible or he's this or that NPR was horrible about it, but was because they wanted that he wouldn't work with a co-host and he wouldn't go out of the building and he wouldn't travel the way they wanted the host to do. So there usually are inner reasons that most people don't know about, you know, that have, they're usually more, things are a little more complex than what sort of gets talked about.
Than what appears on the air.
Exactly. Anyway, we got to go on to another call, but take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Have a great morning. Hi there, you're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. I unfortunately, I haven't been quite paying attention to what's been happening. I'm very shocked that you guys are losing this time slot. Is there any word about the change?
Well, yeah. I mean, in theory, I am no longer going to be, well, not in theory, I'm no longer going to be on from 5 to 7 a.m. That's history as of 7 a.m. this morning. I have been reassigned to 7 to 8 a.m. Saturday mornings, but it is my very, very strong suspicion. I can't speak too much out of school here because this is all stuff in flux and semi-confidential with the program director, et cetera, et cetera. I strongly believe that I will be moved to a different time slot. Maybe a very good one. I don't know which yet. I'm not happy about moving because I've been doing Hour of the Wolf that Margot here created 38 years ago, and I've been doing it for a mere 36. But I do feel that, that change here is intended for the better.
And
I do believe Simon will be back on the air at some point.
Yeah,
I'm a huge supporter.
Was suspended?
Yes.
I'm not sure what does that mean?
It means he's off the air until further notice.
There was an incident. We won't talk about it here.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. It's possibly even controversial for me to say that much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I will not ask anymore.
I will say that if you like my show, if you like Simon's show, if you would like to be heard, send an email to the radio station.
Fortunately, I don't really have computer facility.
Send a letter.
Send a letter. Exactly. Right.
Okay.
Write
an actual letter in the mail with a stamp.
Crazy talk.
Yeah.
You can write it on Word in your computer and then put it in an envelope.
You can use pen and paper. Simon would approve.
And addressing your co-host there,
Margot Adler.
I have to say that it has been. My alarm clock did not go off properly, which is. I may not miss the hour change. I already work really long hours and such. So perhaps it'll be better for my sleep. But the creator and originator of the show. I also definitely would agree. I don't think you've been making fun of the literary or media genre of vampires. And I think when do you think you might be able to get this book of yours out?
Well, I have a couple of offers. I haven't accepted any of them yet. I am thinking that it'll take me 6 to 8 months to write it. And then, you know, usually it takes at least another 6 months or more till they get a book out. So sometimes a year, but you never know. So we're not talking. We're not probably talking for a year and a half. Certainly.
I think isn't it a little odd since you're a known quantity, you're a known writer, isn't this?
Yeah, Drawing Down the Moon has never really been out of print, has it?
Yes, but you know, here's the interesting thing that's been happening with this proposal that's been going around, and I have an agent, and the proposal has been going around. Well, first of all, I want enough money to take 6 months off from work. That's one of the problems. So I've had two offers, but, you know, I've been wanting a little more money than they've been offering. That's number one. And we're in a dark economic time. And the second thing is that this book, just like Drawing Down the Moon, which had its own problems before it finally got taken, stands in what we would call a really odd corridor between what we might call pop culture and serious political philosophical work. So, for example, there are all kinds of people who are commercial publishers who go, oh, well, this is a little too political and philosophical for what we really want. And can't you be like, you know, if you could be Malcolm Gladwell, we'd be very happy. But, you know, that's what we really want you to do. But this doesn't quite sound like that. And then the, you know, a publisher, you know, serious intellectual publisher goes, oh, well, we're interested in your polis, but vampires? Come on, you know. So it falls in that sort of twilight between those things.
No pun intended.
Yeah, no pun intended. It's in that sort of corridor between what we might call, and that's where Drawing Down the Moon was. You know, it was witches and stuff like that, but yet it was a very serious philosophical and political book. And so we're in that same thing. And so that's probably why that it's having less traction than, let's say, a work of fiction would have on vampires.
All right, because it does sound very interesting, and it seems like it would be a really good thing to pop out there. I mean, let's face it, there is like an enormous amount of
I know, billions and billions and billions of dollars are being spent on vampire stuff, yes. Billions, billions and billions, so, you know, couldn't they give me a little bit, right? So.
I find your laugh very funny. I love that. When you are laughing, I think it's very very charming.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Since I was waking up late, there was I guess it's three songs back, some fellows singing about peace in the universe.
Oh, Phil Oakes, I think, is what you were thinking of, probably.
Changes by Phil Oakes, O-C-H-S, one of the greats.
I am sorry about these changes, and it seems like they're going to shrink the show.
It's unclear.
It's unknown.
We don't know.
Actually, one of the reasons why I may not end up being on Saturdays from 7 to 8 is I believe that the programming people are looking for more time for me.
Okay.
Well, it has been expressed to me that way. They're working with me.
Okay, very, very, very good.
And I'm working.
Again, not necessarily clear on some of this. They want to replace the early hours with music?
No. 10 a.m. till noon. We will be bringing back morning music, which was on the air from the 1970s through the 80s. This is not a new thing. But then it was classical music. Now it's going to be more of a world music and jazz and Middle Eastern music, all an interesting blend. Delphine Blue will be on back in her original time slot on Thursdays.
But what would be in the 5 o'clock?
5 a.m. will be a news and public affairs program.
Oh, okay. I'll be sad to see you go, and I will hopefully hear you.
I'm going away from this time slot, which I cherish and love, but I will be on the air. I'll be producing radio dramas. Good things are to come.
Okay, very good, very good. And, Margo, are you in the city?
I am. I am a correspondent at NPR in its New York bureau.
Okay. So when you were talking about running around the reservoir, you're talking about Central Park.
Exactly.
There you go. Okay.
I live on the Upper West Side, actually.
Then hopefully I will see you at some of those readings.
Yes, I have been going to
Margo's been going to my readings,
yes,
at least.
Yes, I've been to like two or three of Jim's
and
readings.
And to one of the KGB readings.
One of the KGB readings, too,
I haven't been to the KGB in a while, but I have been at the Digital Gallery.
Right.
And the last one with, the names are escaping me, the two women writers.
Yes, with Genevieve Valentine
No, not Genevieve Valentine, right?
You missed that one,
I missed
Margo.
That one.
It was packed. It was great, though.
Yeah, it wasn't.
They were very fun.
Oh, yeah, they were great. They were great.
I had, like, a bunch of other thoughts. But
okay, but I have to get... Yeah,
we only have 10 more minutes, so...
Again,
and 3.5 minutes of that is the outro. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
Of course. Again, it was a great pleasure, and good luck to you both. And I'll be looking. Oh, what is the last book that you had out, Margo?
Heretic's Heart, A Journey Through Spirit and Revolution, came out in 1997, and then the revised edition of Drawing Down the Moon came out in 2005, 2006.
Now, but those two are academic books, not
fiction.
They're nonfiction.
They're nonfiction. Okay. They're not academic. They're Heretic's Heart's a memoir.
Okay.
Heretic's Heart's a memoir. Yeah.
But any of your fiction pieces that I should be reading?
I don't have fiction. I am not a fiction writer.
Really?
Margo attended Clarion, but never.
I was telling you that I've been so much of a journalist my whole life that it's been very hard to fictionalize. Because it's going to take me a while. I think when I retire, I'm going to start trying to write fiction. But basically, I've spent 42 years doing radio journalism, and you get so wedded to the idea of sort of trying to be as truthful as you can that it's very hard to be fictional.
Okay.
But in the meantime, you can follow Margo's adventures on All Things Considered
and
Morning Edition.
right. I just came back. Yeah, my next piece, which is going to be on this week on Morning Edition, will be on the cuts at SUNY Albany. And
the cuts
in SUNY, which are really frightening.
Yeah.
The cuts that are going on at the State University of New York are draconian.
And John Langan, who I think you attended
draconian,
his reading,
is
at SUNY New Paltz.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, it's really. I mean, they cut the state cut $640 million from the state budget, which is 30%, and they cut five humanities departments from SUNY Albany, including French, Classics, Italian,
and
Russian.
And I get the idea because we're in a bad way, but
But anyway, we got to go on another call.
Yeah,
but anyway,
that's right.
Okay. But anyway, take
my
care.
Pleasure.
That was great.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye
bye.
Thanks. Bye bye. Great calls this morning. Good morning. You're on the air.
Take care. That was great.
Okay, and we're on delay.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
There.
Hi.
I'm glad to hear Margo's voice again. I've been a supporter since '68, and you're right. It was the war summary and the Tet Offensive coverage that threw in a lot of people. I've been here since then. But
Yeah,
I used to say in a negative way that, unfortunately, WBAI lived off the blood of the Vietnamese, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, I guess the reason I'm calling is I will miss Simon, and I did appreciate his programming, and I liked the jazz that he played. And I think my biggest reason for calling is to just, it seems that no matter what the administration is, changes like this seem to be made in station, and I guess it separates me as a listener because I listen to the radio. I'm not a computer person. And it seems to me as a listener, especially all these years of saying it's listen to this, it's listen to that, you're the blood, you're this, and things like this happen, and it's totally out of the realm of a kind of listener even advising the listeners or...
Well, there isn't, the board is made, there is a listener, people vote for the board. The board is made up of listeners.
Yeah,
our local advisory
board. Well, here's
board.
The problem. Here's the problem, speaking as someone who's been at a lot of different radio ventures. There's always someone who's going to love what's on the air, no matter
Josephson's what. Josephson's Law.
You know, is that Joseph's Law? I mean, people are going to always love.
You could have the worst.
Yeah, yeah, you could have the worst programming on the world, and somebody's going to love it.
I think it's the process that I'm talking
about. Yeah, I understand.
It needs to be consistent no matter who's in charge.
Well, the original theory, of course, is that listener sponsorship is about sponsorship. It's not that listeners vote with dollars. And programming decisions are made by a programming department.
You could argue that if they vote by dollars, they're not voting very much.
Because our dollars have dried up.
I've been told by our Republican representatives here in Staten Island that you vote for me, and I do what I want, and if you don't like it, you vote me out. You know, that may sound good, but...
Yeah, but it is indeed.
Like
yeah.
Anybody's respecting what I'm saying. You know?
I think that's a fair analogy.
That is a fair analogy. Let's go and take one more quick call, right. And then we'll
okay.
Then
thanks
we'll go,
so much. Right,
we don't
have a good.
We
morning.
Only have like
yeah, a couple of moments.
Couple
left.
Minutes. Yeah.
Hi there. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
I am calling from Portland, Oregon, Le Guin Land.
Good.
And I began...
And then what? You must be a New Yorker because you're saying Oregon and not the way they say it in Oregon.
Oh, one of my Harvard roommates in graduate school corrected me that it's Oregon.
It's Oregon. Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon. Yeah.
Oregon.
but I began listening to Unstuck in Time. I missed you when you were on Hour in the Wolf. When I dropped out of Yale as a freshman with Ron Reagan.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
that
my
was
God.
How I was de-depressing from that, listening to Unstuck in Time. And I have this to say about BAI, and it's sort of a vampire-related comment, that it was clear that to use a Joseph Heller phrase, something happened. Something bad happened in, if not the late 70s, in the early 80s, and everything became static and moribund at BAI, and the ex-hippies of BAI became unpaid but life-tenured producers, and more the schedule started to resemble the moribund, ossified nomenclatura of the ex-Soviet Union.
I am so
and
sorry to say that I agree with
century.
You.
I think you're right. You're right. And unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about the reasons for that.
Yeah, we have
which
like
go
yeah.
on, which go on, which we, this could be a whole other program.
And it will be a whole other program because we'll be on, at least I'll be on and I'll invite Margo on. I don't know where,
yeah, but
don't
there
know
is,
when.
There's definitely, yeah.
There's
we
a song
we,
in that. But, I don't know where.
Yeah.
But so we're going to have to
producers and one way to get them on, you know, there's all kinds of eccentrics who call into BAI, but one way to get them on as a farm team would be to create an online programming schedule, like a studio for online.
So it'd sort of be like Radio Rookies, sort of like
yeah.
NYC does
well,
with
I,
Radio
I,
Rookies,
I,
or
actually, you know. I think that's a great idea.
Anyway, we're going to have to go, unfortunately.
Yes, yes.
But
some of the old programmers could also take some slots
okay.
on the online.
Well, why don't you email Jim at jim@ourwolf.com and sort of lay out your proposal in a serious way.
Because it's time for David
to
come on
well,
the air.
Well, as a Harvard PhD in psychology who knew Jerome Kagan well.
I love Jerome Kagan.
Okay, my theme is
already
running.
His theme is, the theme is going on. Goodbye.
Okay,
we
bye,
loved
bye,
you.
Bye.
We
thank
love you.
You.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Okay. Margo, well, it's been special. Thank
you. It's been really great.
Yeah.
It's been really fun. It's been really wonderful.
It was the right way to go out.
It's really wonderful.
With 38 years of Hour of the Wolf, it was the right way to go out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wait, so is it the Wolf ending?
No. This is the last show.
Oh, at this time, Scott.
In the Hour of the Wolf.
Oh,
from 5
the
to
hour
7 a.m.
The coyote will now.
Well, exactly.
The coyote
exactly.
will. The coyote
yeah,
will
the coyote
still,
will howl. There'll be some
cuckoo.
Howling.
You have a cuckoo with
I will continue to be on the air. Don't know where. Don't know when. But something will.
Somewhere.
Don't know.
There's a place for us.
Thank you, everybody, for listening for all these years. Thank you, Margo.
Thank you, Jim.
And,
great.
And stay tuned for David Rothenberg with...
And actually, Hour of the Wolf depends on if it's daylight saving or Eastern.
Well, as somebody called up and pointed out, it's
somebody from
Hour
Bulgaria
of the Wolf.
Said...
Somebody from Bulgaria
Hour of the
called
Wolf
up.
Somewhere in the world.
Exactly.
You, know,
you got
it. That.
Okay. That's right.
So thank you. Again, we go out, of course, with Steel Eye Span.
And especially with the Internet, there are people listening with the Hour of the Wolf.
So have a good morning. Take good care. I love you.
Bye
all.
Bye. We love you.
Bye bye.
Things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Or sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head, I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea, I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull, he collapses. A cheer goes up, I'm saved, and the moral is... You gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face
11 miles long. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
And that's Jimmy Durante, and I'm David Rothenberg, and we're here. This is the last time we'll be starting at 8:30. Starting next week, we'll be on at 8, from 8 to 10. There are changes at BAI. Change doesn't necessarily mean progress. It just means change. Doesn't mean it's not progress, but don't confuse the two. Let's start off with Out on a Limb on this clear, beautiful November morning, November 13th. Well, a pair of compelling movies opened this past week, both with serious political implications. Fair Game, a docudrama, is a vivid retelling of CIA agent Valerie Plame's unmasking by Bush administration officials. If you can recall recent history, Plame's husband, Joe Wilson, authored an op-ed essay in the New York Times exposing the administration's lies about weapons of mass destruction, justifying the war in Iraq. The documentary Client 9 outlines the rise and fall of New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, a movie that deserves your attention as it exposes the political business power block that determines the fate of the state, if not the nation. Both films reflect and reveal how supreme power brokers can destroy public figures and distort the public's perception of vital information. Fair Game and Citizen 9 share an ominous truth that democracy is fragile and an inconvenience when the titans set about to protect their respective domains, even when it is corroded with lies and criminality. In Fair Game, there was one line almost tossed in parenthetically, which was startling news to me. Valerie played with understated intensity by Naomi Watts, is having an exchange with her Mideast contacts at the outset of the Iraqi war, and she's informed by them that all of Saddam's weapons buildup have been destroyed by American bombers in the first Iraqi war, when George Bush Sr. orchestrated the bombings of that beleaguered nation. She's told that American strategists had been informed of that fact. Sean Penn portrays Joe Wilson, Valerie's husband, a former diplomat in the Clinton administration. Wilson was sent to Niger to investigate administration claims that that small African country was sending weapons and dangerous minerals to Saddam. Because of his truth-revealing New York Times essay, high government officials Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and their patsy fall guy, Little Scooter Libby, campaigned to discredit and expose Wilson's wife, who was not known as an agent. The revelation of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent endangered the lives of many of those who served as her Mideast contacts, all of which was secondary consideration to the government officials more determined to protect their war based on lies. In the other film, Client 9, New York Governor Spitzer comes across as more than arrogant. He's a man who has a sense of entitlement reflective of his privileged upbringing. But beyond that, he has a strong public morality and, if somewhat ruthless, was determined, when he was attorney general and later as governor, to expose Wall Street charlatans. His sin was that he was effective and uncompromising. Wall Street feared him, and they were determined that his campaign for strong regulations and oversight on the often criminal business activities would not continue. Political tricksters were hired, and Roger Stone, a man whose character could be compared to Roy Cohn, was on the job. And then we all know of Spitzer's fall from grace. What the movie reveals is that his headline sexual activities were selectively investigated by the FBI and federal prosecutors, while almost no other escort service received such government attention. In the movie, interviews are conducted with Kenneth Langone, a co-founder of Home Depot, Hank Greenberg, former AIG CEO, and convicted felon former state senator Joe Bruno, all enemies of Eliot Spitzer and all determined to bring him down. The movie implies that they used their power, their influence, and their dollars to unmask Spitzer's out-of-marriage sexual peccadilloes. The media did the rest. Village Voice writer Wayne Barrett waxes ironically when he compares the personal sex acts of the government compared to the criminal activity in the Wall Street arena, all of which, after the Spitzer resignation, collapsed under its own excesses. Obviously, the government's involvement with an escort service prompting tabloid photos of voluptuous young women was more than the public could take. The women on The View chatted endlessly about the betrayed Mrs. Spitzer without giving equal time to discuss the betrayal of millions of Americans with foreclosed homes and unemployment as a result of the acts perpetuated by the people Spitzer was going after. I view both films with alarm. Both will play to limited audiences, and I'll watch closely if either gets television airtime, enabling a larger audience to be informed. Don't expect either to be shown on Fox. Fox's film critic at The Post dismissed both pictures. Their ultra-conservative political pundit reviewing Fair Game described it as an asterisk inside a footnote. I guess the Murdoch Empire views the war in Iraq as a footnote, and the exposure of a CIA agent as an asterisk. And that's the kind of reporting amidst the collapse of responsible newspapers and television stations dedicated to reality shows. That's as chilling as the content of Fair Game and Citizen 9. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb.
Call it all, I hear a rhapsody, and when your sparkling eyes are smiling at me, then soft through the starlit sky, I hear a rhapsody. My days are so blue when you're away. My heart longs for you, so won't you stay? My darling, hold me tight and whisper to me, then soft through a starry night, I'll hear a rhapsody. So won't you stay, my darling, hold me tight and whisper to me, then soft through a starry night, I'll hear a rhapsody, then soft through a starry night, I'll hear a
And that's Billy Eckstein. What is your angel? I'll say good morning, but what is that? Is that the...
Mine is gray.
Well, wait, I got to... Now talk.
I said good morning.
Okay, I have to know which mic to use. You see, let me explain to everyone listening, is that I know which microphone Angel is on by the color of the wire attached to it, and then there is a corresponding color on the switchboard, or whatever this board is called, which looks like it could take you to the moon,
mm-hmm.
and I have to punch the right button. So good morning.
Good morning.
On this beautiful dear. Angel and beautiful angel morning.
Yes, it is a beautiful angel morning.
On a November morning. Angel, in the last few weeks, the Castle Gardens opened, the really unique housing. People who read the New York newspapers would never know about it because it wasn't of interest to the New York press. But the Fortune Society opened a 113 affordable apartments in a building that Fortune created and behind the castle.
Mm-hmm.
There was a huge lot there that, and Fortune Society owned the lot. And with the help and the support of a lot of political people, the mayor, Congressman Charles Rangel, State Senator Bill Perkins, Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, Assemblyman Keith Wright, Council Speaker Chris Quinn, Council Member Robert Jackson, and lots of other people, and a lot of private industry and a lot of public funding, the tenacious and effective leadership of Joanne Page built this unique 113-apartment complex. It's about 10, 12 stories with a beautiful roof and
fabulous.
The roof is just wonderful. We'll be having parties up on the roof and great community meeting rooms. 50 of the apartments are, which, and by the way, this is what's unique about it, is that it's affordable apartments. The rents are all much lower than the prevailing ceiling of rents. And Fortune determined that 50 of these apartments would be permanent residents for formerly incarcerated people. And all of them who have left the castle have moved into permanent residence a half a block away, right up the hill on 140th Street. And the other apartments, the other 80 apartments, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms, were to go to the public and people who were in need, low-income community people who could use affordable housing. And, of course, word was out, and we got several calls saying, who's going to live in a building with 50 formerly incarcerated people?
I would.
Well, they got 5,000 applications.
5,000 applications.
And a careful lottery is selected, and the people that have moved in are elated. Well, this is all by way of saying, in this building right behind the castle – and many of you have seen the castle, and now you can see the building next door. There's a wonderful meeting room, which you and I have been in with great acoustics. And so we've decided that the next performance of the play, The Castle, will be in the castle gardens next door in this room where we won't need mics. Was it you that I sat in the room with? You were
in
one end of the room, and
I was like, oh, my God, you can hear me.
We were at the other end of the room talking in this voice and could hear clearly. So the first performance at Castle Gardens is going to be Saturday, December 11th at 3 o'clock. Those of you who have seen the play and want to see it again, this is a great way to see it. Those of you who haven't, you come right up to 140th Street, you find the castle, and then go to the big building next door. It's $20 a person. If you want to sponsor a youth at risk, and we already have a group of 20 that wants to come that day, so we have at least 20 people who could use sponsorship, that's $10 a person. So if you want to be there at Castle Gardens in this beautiful, unique building, and why the media, why the press, I think with the ground opening, with all the political people there and this unique building, it's a green building also, I may add,